You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Yani velev ki o hedefler kaldırılsa dahi 40 askerimizi süratle oradan çekin.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announcing the withdrawal of troops from a NATO drill. And this time he does kind of have good reason to be upset. My guests Christopher Lord and Marcus Hippie will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including how and why Germany became the world's favourite country, why Australia's gain of same-sex marriage is New Zealand's loss, and which city has the planet's best subway. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Christopher Lord and Marcus Hippie. Welcome both. Now, first of all, one of the most valuable people in any organisation is the one who can be relied upon when someone advances a terrible idea to respond, "Guys, this is a terrible idea." Whoever occupies this role at one military base in Norway was clearly on leave this week. At a NATO training exercise in Norway, a poster of an imaginary enemy was unfurled, featuring on one side the name of Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and on the other, the image of modern Turkey's founder, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Unsurprisingly, Turkey withdrew their troops from this exercise. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has apologised. Chris, first of all, you spend a lot of time in Istanbul as our Turkey correspondent. How on earth can something like this actually... I mean, this is not a good look, whoever... you feature on the target, especially if it is the commander-in-chief of an actual NATO ally, but of all the ones they could have picked.
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, it's pretty bad. I mean, the fact that, first of all, that Atatürk really is almost the figurehead of the Turkish military, the secular head of the country, the secular face of the foundation of modern Turkey, as you say. What I think striking here is, you know, we've seen Turkey since the coup last year, or the failed coup last year, I should say, basically fringe the point of being kicked out of NATO. I mean, they're almost there, really, in terms of, NATO, it is a requirement to be loosely democratic. It is a requirement to sort of have some sort of stability and rule of law in your country. And they've almost gone away from that completely. So this operation was kind of supposed to be a way of bringing Turkey, you know, back. Let's bring a lot of military in. Let's get a lot of soldiers here. Let's get everybody interacting again and make it work. So I imagine Stoltenberg must be saying, this is the one thing we didn't want to happen. However, his comments were quite telling. He said that it was the incidents are the result of an individual's action and do not reflect the views of NATO. And he's sort of, he blamed it on a civilian who was a contractor there. So it's a very surreal situation.
I guess what else can you do in that situation when you're trying to rescue what still can be rescued? It's quite dramatic in any case, Turkey withdrawing 40 soldiers, considering that the relations between Turkey and many other NATO countries have been quite strained ever since the failed coup attempt last year.
I mean, that is all true, but Chris, Erdogan, as you know, profits from a narrative of me against the world, that the whole world is ganging up on us, that we are mocked and teased and persecuted, and I will restore pride to the nation. This is potentially a massive gift to him. How much of a thing is he likely to make of it?
Well, I'm going to give a bit of a counterpoint to that, Andrew, is that you're right. Normally, he loves it when somebody shows Turkey to be, you know, the wounded individual. He's the man who will show the world.
This time he does kind of have a case.
And this time, he's the first time he has a case. But actually, there's a kind of counterpoint here, which is that normally that is the case. And this is also true here. But also, Erdogan is desperate to bring the secularists back on his side to some extent, if he can. If there ever was a side that he was potentially on, right now he is doing it. If you look in the last week, we've seen that the most powerful company in Turkey is 85% military owned. So no longer your Koçs and your Garantas, the old families that used to run the show in terms of the economy. The most powerful company and profitable company is military owned ultimately. So there's that. Secondly, he's now got his biggest contender comes from the far right nationalist, ultra hardcore Atatürk secularist promoter, Meral Akşener, who comes from the nationalist MHP party. If they go to the polls, if he calls an early election, she is going to be his primary opposition. And so he is desperate to bring on those Atatürk-loving, secularist, hardcore, far, you know, nationalist Turks onto his side. So the army is the basically the wing of those people. That is their representation in the running and the state of Turkey. So this whole thing, I think the fact of withdrawing those troops, forget the fact that he's on there. I think it's the Atatürk thing that's driving this partly here. He needs to show that he is on the side of the military 100% because it is political at the moment.
Marcus, as we've been saying there, the NATO has been at pains to say that this was a civilian contractor who has, you know, acting on their own initiative. Perhaps they thought they were making a point or just thought they were being funny, but they have been suspended pending further disciplinary action. Does this really reflect on NATO? Is it entirely NATO's fault if some civilian contractor does something daft?
I guess it's always the responsibility of whoever has commissioned that person to do something. You should make sure that you hire the right people and something like this can't happen. So in a way, I do feel like there is a valid reason for Turkey and for Erdogan to be upset about what's been going on over there.
And there was one thing just to add to that. I mean, you've got to remember as well, it's happened in Norway. So a country where just in March, the government granted Turkish soldiers who basically don't want to go home since the coup, for whatever reason that may be, granted them asylum in Norway. So it's not just about NATO. It's also kind of about Norway-Turkish relations, European Union, or Europe relations with Turkey and so on. It's a very charged situation, and I think I can't believe it's unfolded the way it has. You couldn't write it, Andrew.
It is extraordinary. It remains to be seen how much of a diplomatic flap this becomes. But let's move along and take a look at Germany, which is, as of now, apparently the world's favourite nation, which is quite a turnaround in 70 years or so. The latest National Brands Index survey by GfK and Simon Anholt declares that Germany has the world's best brand image. Germany tips out of top spot the United States, which has dropped to sixth for some reason or another. Filling out the podium are France and the United Kingdom. Australia is ranked at a frankly outrageously low ninth. Honestly, what is wrong with everybody? And I'm not seeing Finland anywhere.
How upsetting.
On this list, Marcus.
Are you asking why we are not there?
Sweden is on. Is Sweden better than Finland, Marcus?
I guess we talk about soft power over here as well.
You're not answering the question. I'm just clearly in here at 10.
I'm just saying that Sweden is more visible. I give you that. Sweden is more visible in some aspects when you look at the worldwide visibility. Just think of Swedish music and how many songs you've heard from there and how many songs you've heard from Finland. That's cultural power. That's soft power.
So you're admitting that the Swedes are better at music than the Finns?
I think Finland is getting better gradually. Just give us a few years and we'll show you.
Are we surprised, Chris, by this survey?
No, I don't think we are surprised. I mean, first of all, I don't think we're surprised that the US has dropped so dramatically that it has. I mean, if you look at the research that's been done just in the last 6 months about...
We probably don't need to spend a lot of time discussing the reasons for that.
I mean, it's pretty obvious. And, you know, and I think that is really important. I think, you know, we have to understand just a couple of things just to say on this. You know, this study where this has come from is done by a German think tank. So this is one thing to say. So it's German research that says Germany's the best.
Except, to bear that in mind. In fairness, in previous years it hasn't. I mean, there would be cause for suspicion there if it's like, and for the 25th year running, it's Germany.
But yes, that is a fair point. But I think it is important. And the reason I think that it's the way it is, and I do agree to some extent about how Germany has in the last few years created an astonishing national brand and keeps hitting that national brand. What I mean is it's remained faithful to a certain brand that it's built in recent years. If you think of things like the response to the refugee crisis in 2015, if you think of the key things that they're looking at here in terms of governance, you know, Angela Merkel gets voted in yet again for another term. People, if we look at some, you know, even people like Helena Fischer, you know, people like that, people who are getting noticed internationally as Germans and with something to say in the world. And I think they've remained true to it. I think what we've seen in the past year, especially if we think about Brexit, is these national brands, it's about how faithful you can be to the brand that you've built over the last few years. If you take the UK and what happened with Brexit, in the immediate aftermath, so many people said to me, I was in Turkey at the time, so many people said, I just didn't think the British would do that. It just didn't seem like what the UK would do.
Quite a lot of people didn't think the British would do that.
But that's the point, Andrew. It's because they built a national brand that was totally different from what that vote was about. And I think what Germany has done in recent years is remain true to that brand. And it is because of Merkel. It is a big doubt because of Merkel. The biggest danger to this, of course, is the emissions scandal. This is the biggest problem they face right now, because you cannot build a national brand which is about precision and reliability and stability and all that sort of thing and have your biggest soft power manufacturing industry have a major scandal of wrongdoing.
I would also add on the list the Berlin airport saga that keeps on continuing and continuing, considering the Germans have a great reputation for their engineering skills. That disaster that's been taking place in Berlin for years is also reflected. It's making international news headlines regularly. I'm also wondering where German brand would be indeed without Angela Merkel. I think Angela Merkel is essential when it comes to the brand Germany at the moment. She's taken the position of being some kind of a moral leader, the supporter of Western values, when it seems that the US is not doing that so much in this era of Donald Trump.
Are you surprised, Marcus, that the UK has clung on to third place? Because the obvious reason why the United States' reputation has plummeted is that its people made an electoral decision that kind of baffled the rest of the world, which obviously the UK did the year before.
I think that's a very good question. I don't really know how to answer that. In a way, I find it interesting that the UK hasn't fallen from that position. But at the same time, I think it's interesting that maybe the world understands that this country is so divided when it comes to the question Brexit. And maybe it is that the British people going abroad and going to Europe and meeting fellow Europeans are not going on about Brexit and how they want to leave Europe. Maybe it's also about personal connections, interactions between people.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Chris, speaking on behalf of the entirety of your 65 million fellow citizens, what would you think of as Britain's brand now? What would you think of it as constituting? And do you think the Brexit thing has changed it?
It's a really good question, Andrew. I mean, I think...
two in a row. I
think,
a hat-trick.
Yeah, I think in one sense, you know, if we look at these metrics that these guys have rated this on, yeah, the UK still does pretty well. I mean, things like tourism, you know, the people that we still have, you know, we look at... There are still great brand Britain ambassadors out there, you know, smart people, musicians, you know, artists, writers, all these, you know, the world still looks to Britain to create great culture. It is a fact. And heritage and culture is something that they looked at here. The trouble with the Brexit thing, as I was kind of saying before, is, you know, it has, I think it's just shook this idea that was in place for a long time, which was that, yeah, okay, we can talk on one side about Brexit, about, you know, yeah, okay, it's a place open, the world can come, they can come and do business, they can come and live here and create and be part of a very fluid national identity that people can all kind of be part of and so on. That, yeah, I mean, that has definitely been shook by Brexit. But I think what the other thing, the kind of more damaging bit, is the absolute fiasco since. That's the real problem. It's the governance that's happened since then. Because there was a time where the UK, for all its faults, you know, for all its, you know, history and problems of its history, it was regarded as a safe pair of hands. It was regarded as a place where it could still get things done. And since that Brexit vote, it's been such an absolute horror show of politics and daft elections and gambles that it doesn't seem like the sort of considered, if slightly wily, place that people used to think it was.
Marcus, returning to Finland, and I'll give you a chance to speak.
Are you
on
asking
behalf,
again why we are not on this list?
Well, no, I'm trying to be constructive. I don't want to harp on about the fact that Finland isn't in the top 10 of the world's most beloved countries, while Australia clearly is. But if you have a country like Finland, which, as you say, is kind of quiet and less known than its neighbour Sweden, for example, is there anything Finland could or should do that would improve its brand image in the eyes of the world? Or is it just the thing that, I mean, when you think of the Finnish people who are internationally famous, they tend to be racing drivers who are very well known for never actually saying anything. Mm-hmm.
It's true. I guess when you're a small country and you don't have that much resources to build that country brand, you just have to be cleverer. And I think it's interesting, I was going to mention actually Monocle's soft power survey, because these things are not totally different. Looking at this ranking list,
quite similar criteria
we're talking about,
in some respects, yes.
Like Germany is doing quite well on the Monocle ranking list as well. But I think it's interesting that when I'm looking at Finland in the position 18 on Monocle soft power survey, it's being pointed out
that... Can you remind us where Australia was, Marcus?
number... Do you remember? It's number nine.
Number nine.
Yeah. Anyway,
that's higher than 18.
It is. I give you that. But anyway, Monocle makes a very good point
nine
over here
higher,
that
Marcus.
That Finland kind of didn't realize one nice thing that actually gave it worldwide attention, and that was the Finnish president Sauli Niinistö's dog. I can't remember. It's some kind of a boxer dog, a small one. It's a French bulldog, isn't it? And it just had a funny face. And that photo of the Finnish president or his wife carrying that small dog, which had this funny face, made international headlines. And I think that's exactly what small countries should somehow try to learn to do. I don't know. I guess these things often happen by coincidence.
It was like
a mascot for Finland for a while.
But in the same way, and I the first Finnish passport I saw was yours when you showed it to me, but it went kind of viral. That cool thing with the flip animation, where if you flick the pages of your passport together, you get a moose walking.
I thought you were going to say it also featured a funny face.
I think that's more the next edition of Passport.
But actually, just on what Marcus is saying, I have to fully agree with what he's saying there, is that I think in our time, you've got to have a little bit of a... You've got to play the soft power from time to time. Is that the Finns are really keen, on a national level, if I'm right to say, Marcus, on pushing, oh, we can be a tech hub.
We're kind of
buying into a bit that Estonia thing. Oh, we're kind of open and we're digital and this. But actually, if you can just capture people with a little bit of a human thing, you win. You win on soft power.
I know, and you have to... Exactly. You have to win people's attention the world over. If you decide that we are a country, we are famous of our design heritage and how we do that thing. How do you catch people's attention around the world?
Andrew,
what does it take?
What do you think about that? Australia in at nine. What's your thoughts?
Oh, there? I'm outraged. Obviously, what is all I have to say to that? How are there possibly eight countries in the world that people like more than they like Australia? I mean, it's our humility for a start should endear us hugely to people. I'm not surprised by it. In all seriousness, nine out of an entire world is actually quite high. I mean, I've travelled a lot. And I travel with an Australian passport and therefore have some understanding of how that gets received in the world. And generally the image people have of Australians is a very, very favourable one. You can argue whether they're correct or not to do so. But in quite a few places, especially in the Middle East and in Central Asia, more than once I can remember a given situation suddenly becoming a lot less tense than it might have been once someone's realised I'm not American and I'm not British and am in fact Australian. And then it is weird how quickly they can regard you quite differently.
I think Canadians experience the same kind of neutral approach.
Indeed.
I feel like I have to make a very important point about the Australians, by the way.
You are
viewed so favourably in the Nordic region that, for example, in Helsinki, there's an Aussie bar, which is this awful concept.
They try to
catch these five Australian guys living in the country, make them work behind the bar. And what happens after that?
Was there an organised hunt? Were there nets and ropes?
Because there aren't that many of them. They are needed. Anyway, what happens when you place these five Australian guys behind the bar is that there's a chaos. There's 100 blonde women all trying to get a piece of them.
We're a good-looking people, Marcus. I don't know what to tell you. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Christopher Lord and Marcus Hippie. Coming up next, why Australia's legalisation of gay marriage might be bad news for New Zealand.
Monocle invites you to raise a glass of blue wine at the annual Monocle Christmas Market. Join us for this winter wonderland of a weekend complete with warming treats from the Monocle Cafe, reindeer petting, and an appearance from our fluffy mascot, Monochan, all set to a festive playlist. You can also try your hand at our ever-popular tombola and meet our VIP Santa Claus all the way from Finland. The 2017 Monocle Christmas Market takes place on Saturday, December 2nd and Sunday, December 3rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at our Midori House HQ here in Marylebone. Find all the details at monocle.com. We hope to see you there.
You're You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Christopher Lord and Marcus Hippie. Now, this week we learned that a heartening 61.6% of participants in Australia's plebiscite on same-sex marriage voted yes. So, hooray. It is vaguely heartbreaking, however, to ponder how much higher that number might have been if the Yes campaign had emphasised the degree to which a vote for same-sex marriage would also annoy New Zealand. The Kiwis got with the programme on this back in 2013 and have been doing nicely ever since, from gay Australian couples flying across the Tasman to get married. This trade does now appear more or less doomed. Marcus, should countries learn from this? If countries have more, I mean, obviously people should just legalise same-sex marriage anyway, but is there more of an imperative if you live next door to a very conservative country and you have agreeable scenery and pleasant venues, you can make a real thing of it?
I think so. I mean,
Finland is right next to Russia, for
example. Exactly. And Finland actually gets a fair number of Russian gay tourists nowadays who feel like they can't actually be themselves in Russia. But I think that's a very good idea. And I think it's surprising. I like this story because I haven't really realised that something like this was going on in New Zealand. The gay marriage scene has been blossoming over there, and even though we're not talking about thousands and thousands of gay couples getting married over there, but you know, just getting some hundreds over there, bringing their friends and bringing their families to spend a lot of money, that can make a difference. I think it's very clever, and I think many countries should, after this story, start thinking about if they could try to brand themselves as an ideal destination for gay marriages.
Well, New Zealand, the venues and enterprises in New Zealand that have been profiting from this are now talking about having to advertise perhaps slightly further afield. And this is, of course, a difficulty New Zealand faces in that it's reasonably close to Australia, for example, but it is a heck of a long way from almost everywhere else. But Chris, this does open up a wider and I think really interesting question about the extent to which social reforms, the social progress, if you like, is in fact actually driven by economics rather than any particular advance in human decency. There's always been this argument that the advances of civil rights for black people in the United States, for example, was driven to a large actual extent by the fact that more and more black people actually had a disposable income and more white businesses were realizing, well, it's kind of dumb not to take their money.
That is to be considered. But I would also, you know, going back to what we were talking about before the break about soft power here, is that for New Zealand, this is super powerful soft power. I mean, this is an extraordinary thing that's been working in their favour for several years, you know, for years and years. It's a way of showing not just to Australians, but also in Asia Pacific in general, that here is a place where you can come and you can be whatever you want to be and you're free. And yes, we're, as you mentioned, Andrew, far from so many places. We're very remote islands, but we are open, we are free, and we've got the kind of social justice and reforms that make us a very modern and contemporary place. I would argue, you see, there's another example of this I would give, which is Taiwan. So Taiwan, the first country in Asia to legalise same-sex marriage. It's an amazing soft power boon for that country, because what have they got off the mainland? They've got essentially the colonial power of theirs, China, who, of course, this is where this isn't illegal, where there is not the same freedom of speech, freedom of to be who you want to be. And so there in Taiwan, it all feeds into a broader image of a freer, softer place that you can go and be where you want to be. I think that's so important for our time. And I think that the economic benefits, yes, I see, but that soft power element, I think, is very, very important. I mean, I can give you just one more example, would be in a very, very different thing, but would be Bahrain's place in the Middle East, is that for years and years, that was the place that if you lived in a conservative Saudi Arabia or you lived in Kuwait, that was the place you could go and let your hair down. So whenever Gulf Arabs met Bahrainis, they thought, hey, that's the place you can go and you can have fun and you can drink and you can be yourself and you can go to the beach and you don't have to think about it. That is real soft power.
Absolutely. I'm trying to think of other places where it would actually benefit a country if they all of a sudden decided to legalise gay marriage. Obviously, you know, looking at into Africa, South Africa is the only country that actually at the moment allows same-sex marriage. It probably isn't realistic to imagine that there would be many other countries following suit. But can you imagine if there was one country that all of a sudden decided to do that? That would totally change our perceptions.
I wouldn't be surprised if we see that happen, Marcus, to be very honest with you. I would wonder if one of those Levantine countries, possibly Jordan or Lebanon or somewhere like that, looks to that as a way of of a soft power, as a soft power in the region, as a way to bring investment, as to engage with the world, in a sense.
And also, what we're also talking about is attracting foreign talent to come into your country or into your city. I think that's a very important point as well. When you are a creative, there are many things you could consider when you are moving somewhere. And I think we are talking about these kind of things exactly. Are you accepted there? Does the society, you know, does it accept your sexuality, for example? Is it good for you to be in that place? And you can only win in that, really, I think, if you decide to, you know, make things as good for those people as possible.
Well, indeed so. And finally tonight, if you have recently found yourself thinking that your train is late, spare a thought for the commuters of the western suburbs of Helsinki, who've been waiting several years for a long-promised extension of Helsinki's metro. When I say waiting for several years, they've been doing other things. You know, they've been going to work and raising families. And Marcus, I'm assuming this. Is there actually a railway platform somewhere in the western suburbs of Helsinki on which there's just this crowd of sort of solemn, silent Finnish people in big, thick coats with snow now coming up to their necks have just been waiting there for years for this train?
It's actually quite amusing that where this underground train is going to now, they didn't really want to have it because they all were... Well,
then what's everyone complaining about? We should say that the reason we're talking about this is that this long-promised extension
is
opening tomorrow.
Exactly. So the interesting thing is that Helsinki really wanted to expand its underground network to the neighbouring city of Espoo, which is part of Greater Helsinki. And Espoo was a bit reluctant. They didn't really want to have it because they all have their private cars and they all think it's a status symbol and they want to drive to the city centre of Helsinki and block all the roads. And Helsinki was trying to fight against that.
The long winter evenings must fly
exactly,
by.
Exactly, exactly. So what followed was a bit of a disaster considering that the prices have spiralled and that extension has proven to be way more expensive than it was supposed to be. Last year in August, there was a massive advertising campaign declaring that the Western Extension is opening, and they actually cancelled all the bus routes from the western parts of Helsinki because the underground was opening. And just one or two days before it was due to open, they announced that actually we have some issues, so it's not going to happen. It's been 15 months, and now it's finally opening.
If you people want to get into that top 10, you are going to have to sort this stuff out. This just isn't good enough.
I know. At the same time, having said that, I think we should talk about which places have got the best public
transport. Well, this is what we wanted to do.
I think Helsinki is going to be doing quite well thanks to this underground, but having said that, it's not that great when it comes to other aspects. This underground doesn't really go anywhere. It's just one line, effectively. And if you want to go elsewhere, you still have to take a very slow tram that goes every 10 minutes a bus.
We have got a couple of minutes in which to settle the issue of which country has the world's best, you know, metro subway system. I can't honestly make a serious claim for either Sydney or Melbourne because they're terrible.
I quite like the Sydney Metro. No?
Are you insane?
Is it not the double-decker...
The actual train carriages are quite nice when they actually turn up and then go somewhere, but that's not something you can necessarily rely on.
Yeah. Were you actually
going to say Sydney?
No, I wasn't going to say. Although I quite enjoy Sydney's metro. I think it's kind of a nice place.
Controversial, but carry on.
In a similar vein to what Marcus is maybe talking about here, I can't say it's a great and functional and brilliant metro service, but I think of all the most useless metro services I've ever seen in my life, there is incredibly a metro train. It's probably running right now, back and forth, up and along the palm-shaped island in Dubai, and it was built 10 years ago. I was one of the first passengers to ever go on it, believe it or not. And it is the most useless elevated metro you will ever go on in your life. It goes from three stations where nobody uses public transport and ends at a large international hotel where definitely you won't be taking public transport to reach there. And it costs them millions to create.
Sounds great.
Thing.
Marcus, do you have a particular favourite? You're not allowed to say Helsinki.
I was going to say London, even. I think London has done a great job. You don't need to wait for your train for particularly long. And also, contrasting it to New York, for example, where I spent a few months, I never quite figured out the underground system over there. There weren't screens, at least I didn't find them. I never knew when my train was coming. And when it finally arrived, it was all crowded and I couldn't fit in. So basically, my 3 months in New York, I spent all my money just taking those yellow cabs.
Well, I'm calling my pick. I'm calling a tie between Moscow and St. Petersburg because I like the old school.
You like chandeliers.
I like the old school Soviet art, and chandeliers actually above the tracks. It is amazing.
Really?
They are genuine works of art. The Moscow and St. Petersburg metros, they're wonderful. That does bring us that slightly recherché travel tip to the end of today's show. Christopher Lord and Marcus Hippie, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Bill Lutie, researched by Gaia Lutz and Chloe Karnesis. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, from whom we have just heard, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London. Until then, have a great weekend. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.